You've heard of them. They don't have to talk about themselves because everyone else already does. They demand that the world bend to their will. On the next Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, legendary. Legendary. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Stay tuned. This Snap Judgment podcast is supported by MailChimp. More than 5 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to send email newsletters, and MailChimp also distributes hats for cats and small dogs. More at MailChimp.com. Sometimes I have small thoughts, tiny little thoughts, and I may think to myself, not today. Not right now. I don't want to write the great American novel anymore. I don't want to go to Mars today. Lord, I just want to get the next 3 hours of this conference call so I can go home, drink a glass of wine, maybe watch some Netflix. That's all. That's all I want of the world. Small things. But some people, they keep their eye on the prize. They don't bend to the world's dictates. The world's got to bend to theirs. And they have tales to tell. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present Legendary. Amazing stories from real people bound and determined to burn their mark onto this big blue marble. My name is Glenn Washington. Go ahead, hang up on your conference call. Tell them no, you can't call back later because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. We're going to start off today's episode in one of the wildest places left in the lower 48, a place where the hunter and the hunted go round and round in an eternal struggle. And our hero, our heroine, has four legs. Snap Judgment's Joe Rosenberg has only the two. Snap Judgment.
Well, I very much subscribe to the idea, and maybe I'm spoiled or ruined, that country without wolves isn't really good country. It's incomplete. Doesn't have its full spirit.
Doug Smith is a biologist with the National Park Service, and 20 years ago, he was asked to help reintroduce wolves to Yellowstone National Park.
And so when I got to Yellowstone in 1994... I walked the landscape and it felt flat, dull. Without wolves, it just didn't crackle. And I know that sounds odd for a scientist to say that, but you get this feeling that you get no other place is when you're on a landscape that has wolves. So we took Yellowstone and we dropped maybe the biggest symbol of wilderness in the world in the middle of it. And that symbol did well.
The wolves took to Yellowstone like they'd been born there. And Doug and his team were able to study them up close in a way wolves had never really been studied before.
I mean, we knew them intimately. We knew their stories. We knew their pups. We knew their battles. We knew their, you know, loves, losses, everything. But more and more, I began just to hear about this one wolf, this female. I would go out in the field and people would come up to me and tell me their stories, and they were tingling. I mean, they were excited. I couldn't shut them up.
She was the Angelina Jolie of wolves in Yellowstone.
This is park biological technician Rick McIntyre. And the wolf he's describing was known as the 06 female. 06 because that's the year she was born. People often remarked on her beautiful gray coat, but also her unusual size for a female.
And I think in terms of the Yellowstone male wolves, from their perspective, she was drop-dead gorgeous. But in her case, it wasn't really until she left home when she was about 2 years old that we really began to figure out that there was something special about her.
Rick says that when a wolf leaves home, normally the top priority is to find a mate and start raising pups.
But she was in no rush at all. And one particular mating season, she had five different male suitors. As far as I know, that's a world record for a wild wolf, and dumped every one of them. None of them met her standards. So it was like she was waiting for the time to be right for something to happen.
One of the reasons the 06 female could afford to take her time, and also one of the other reasons she was the Angelina Jolie of wolves, was that she had, in addition to her good looks, another gift.
We've pretty much worked out how wolves hunt, and we have found that the most efficient group size for hunting is four. And the division of labor is young males and females select and chase and grab, and big males come in and use their size and strength for the takedown. 06 did the whole thing by herself, repeatedly.
And her technique was a dangerous one. Normally, wolves want the elk or the deer to run away from them. But what she preferred would be to have a standoff with an elk where it was face-to-face, direct combat to the death. And a bull elk can be 700 pounds. And so if you're facing an elk, they can charge forward, rear up like a stallion, and trample you into the ground, or send you sailing into the air and gore you to death. So she would get in the most dangerous position, and she would dodge the attack very agilely. And then when the moment was right, she'd make her move. She'd run directly at the elk, jump as high as she could in the air, turn her jaws to the side, and grab the throat. So that was her gift when it came to hunting. It's just a masterfully impressive endeavor. So I just never got tired of watching her in action.
Another thing that made 06 a joy to watch in the wild was that, unlike a lot of other wolves in Yellowstone, she didn't sport one of those ungainly radio collars. Even though radio collars helped Doug and his team track the wolves, study them, and ultimately protect them.
And if you can only have one wolf collared, you want her. We catch the wolves by shooting them with a tranquilizing dart. I've personally darted probably over 300 wolves. But 06 was a mix of speed and intelligence that I've rarely seen. I would see her in the field. I would see her from the airplane. And most vividly, I would see her from the helicopter. And she would look at me with disdain. And most other wolves just ran. They got out of there. But what she would do is she would look at me and our eyes would connect. And the look she would give would be, I don't like you at all. And I'm going to outsmart you. And I'd tell the pilot, get that one. Get that gal. And then he'd start nosing in on her and maybe even juice the throttle a little bit to pick up a little speed. And somehow, and I can't explain it, you know, she'd use stuff to her advantage. A few times she used the trees, and a few times she actually used some rocks, but we could never catch her in a bad spot. And it began about a three-year period where I couldn't get her.
It was around this same time that 06 finally decided to form a pack, mating with two young brothers.
And they didn't know anything. And we certainly were wondering why, after all the other big, tough, impressive male wolves that had courted her, did she want to end up with these inexperienced brothers? To us, it really didn't make sense, because she had to do the lion's share of work to make sure that her pups were going to survive. So when they were a few weeks old, she had recovered enough from having given birth that she was able to go out and hunt. And after maybe 10 minutes leaving the den site, she had already killed two elk.
The two brothers would almost stand aside and look on like, why should we do it? Because she's going to do it. In fact, there's some evidence that she taught those two males how to hunt, period. And because of her provisioning, she raised 13 pups to a full year of age. That's way above the average.
And in 2012, there was a pretty major incident that happened that really showed what 06 was capable of in terms of being the ultimate survivor. She was down in the den nursing her newborn pups, not really recovered from having given birth. And there was a problem that was approaching, and that was their rival pack, their deadliest enemy, the Molly's wolves. 16 adult wolves were heading straight for her den site. And her side was totally outnumbered. And a few minutes after the Molly's wolves went into the thick forest, we saw a whole bunch of wolves running out of the trees. And out in front was the 06 female running desperately for her life. All 16 of the rival wolves were chasing her. And she was not able to run fast because of having just had her pup. So she was in a desperate situation. What had made it worse was that she was running toward the top of a cliff. It was almost like an Indiana Jones movie. And she would have to stop at the top of the cliff, turn around. And even for the 06 female, as great a fighter as she was, there was nothing that she could do if she was attacked simultaneously by 16 rival wolves. So as I was watching this, I was resigned to the fact that I was going to see her torn apart. But I underestimated her, because what I didn't know, and the other wolves didn't know, was that there was a little bit of a gully that she could run down. The Molly's wolves were confused. They didn't know what happened. They were looking around for her. But there was still a major problem. They were between her and her den site, and all they had to do was follow her scent trail backwards and kill all of her pups. Well, all those years of training that she had put into her family paid off at that moment. One of her adult daughters came into totally plain sight, put herself in extreme danger because there was no way that the Molly's wolves could not see her. She ran to the east, which meant that she was leading them away from the pups. And that particular daughter was the fastest wolf in 06 family, and she just left him in the dust. And after just a couple of minutes of the chase, the Molly's wolves just gave up in frustration, and they went home, and they never bothered 06 family again.
After that, 06's pack thrived. She had overcome every obstacle thrown her way, and she was now the undisputed queen of Yellowstone.
And so despite what I said before, I kind of quit wanting to get her. We all like an underdog. And when you get to know an individual of another species, like we all did her, you just begin to kind of respect that individual. In this case, that wolf, because she was worthy of just being left alone. And so catching her ended up being a mistake. And it was a mistake that she made that I can't believe she did. We were out February 2012 darting wolves like we've done 100 times. And I just wanted to catch two wolves. And any two won't be her, guaranteed. And the pilot, he goes, "How about that one?" And he spots this wolf right there out of the side of the helicopter. I forget how far it was, but it was in one of those big openings that, you know, me, the guy trying to catch him, really relishes. And I had a split second thought where I thought, yeah, I don't want to get the 06 female, but there's no way she'd do that. She's on her way to the trees, or she's taking a gully out. And I knew her daughter was, in a lot of ways, a look-alike daughter to her mama. And so I thought, well, this is probably her. So I said to the pilot, "Great, go after that wolf." We moved her down to the river, which was completely frozen over with ice. And I waited for that moment. And she came out on the ice, and I landed a dart right in her back. All great. And we landed, rotor blades going. I got out, I walk up to the wolf, and I see a smudge of blood under her tail. That's the vulva area of a wolf. That's an indication that this wolf is a breeder.
In other words, it was an indication that this was the pack's alpha female, 06.
So bang, when I saw that blood, I went, oh no. And I've handled over 500 wolves. And all of them, to me, are beautiful. I mean, that's just a bias I have. But she was a beautiful gray. And there's nothing like a beautiful female gray wolf. And I didn't want to collar her. I dreaded it. But there was just so much at stake. Because from the perspective of science, from the perspective of knowledge, of learning about these animals that we so much want to help, this is the number one wolf you want to get. And here we got her. And so that's how she came to be collared.
The collar allowed them to track O6's movements. But when they did, they saw her do something that, to their knowledge, she had never done before.
At a certain point, the family crossed the park border. And they didn't know it, but they were in a section of Wyoming where wolf hunting was very legal. And in mid-November, the pack was seen by a hunter. I don't know who it was. And the biggest wolf in the pack was shot and killed.
The wolf that had been shot was the seventh wolf killed that season in an area of Wyoming that permitted eight wolves to be killed. The quota had been agreed to by the National Park Service as a way to keep wolf numbers down outside of Yellowstone. It had been one of the compromises with the surrounding communities that allowed wolves to remain in the park at all. O6, of course, had no way of knowing any of this. In her mind, everywhere was like Yellowstone.
So one wolf left on the quota, and I think everybody was worried that another wolf from that pack would get shot. But through all of that, I thought she wouldn't get shot just because it was her. Heck, I tried to shoot her with a helicopter flying above her, and I couldn't get that done for 3 straight years. And so I didn't think she'd get shot with a rifle by someone on the ground.
To Doug and Rick's relief, after her mate was killed, O6 and the rest of her family hightailed it back to the park.
So we thought when they came back to the park, that would be it. They've kind of, quote, learned their lesson. But they went right back out.
And then I remember one evening getting a call from a co-worker where he had gotten word for Wyoming that the eighth wolf was dead. And I think the wording was that it was a gray female, which would have been a description of O6. So I went to bed that night realizing that it may well be her. And then as I was driving in before sunrise the next morning, I got a text and it was confirmation that, yes, it was 06. And unfortunately, at that point, my job was to tell everyone that had known her so well that she had died. And that was pretty hard.
I didn't think they'd get her. And they did. And why they did, I don't know. I thought she was immune. But it's naive to think that we have a wolf running around in Yellowstone that's untouched by humans. And there is a part of me that wishes that was true, that wolves like 06 could be forever wild. So it's painful to confront it and say, we just don't live in that kind of world anymore.
In other words, collar or no collar, hunting quota or no hunting quota, wolves only live in Yellowstone so long as we want them there. And that was very much on Rick's mind the next spring when he was asked to give a talk to some school kids in a neighboring town.
And so the teacher and the kids joined me. There were only a few of them. It was a very small school. But before I could say anything, one of the kindergarten boys started to talk. And this is what he said. I know the man that shot that famous wolf. And of course, he was talking about the 06 female. Everyone was talking about her. And I understand how young boys are. I wanted to move on. I wanted to get into my talk. But before I could do that, the same boy opened his mouth and said, my dad just bought a license to kill a wolf. And once again, man, what can you say to that? Wolf hunting is legal. And I just didn't know how to handle the situation. And I was kind of getting mad at myself for being at the mercy of this five-year-old boy. But he had one more thing to say. And I was thinking to myself, oh, man, I might as well just go home. I can't deal with this. It's too hard. So after saying, I know the man that shot that famous wolf. My daddy just bought a license to kill a wolf. This was his next statement. But I hope he doesn't. He hopes that his dad doesn't kill that wolf that he has the license for. So I like to think of that as being one of the most important parts of the legacy of the 06 female.
Now, just in case you were wondering, Doug Smith and Rick McIntyre both say that 06's pack is continuing to do well in the Lamar Valley region of Yellowstone National Park. Big thanks to both Doug and Rick. That story was produced by Joe Rosenberg. The sound design by Renzo Gorio. When Snap Judgment continues, we meet a guy that actually has songs written about his exploits. And at long last, finally, we celebrate the marketing department. When Snap Judgment, the legendary episode continues, stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to Snap. Heard something in the news about the economy that you just don't get? Turn to Planet Money from NPR. It's a clever take on topics of money and markets and making it fresh and exciting. Look for NPR's Planet Money on iTunes under podcast.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the legendary episode. Today, we're diving headfirst into the real stories of larger-than-life people, real people. Maybe someone living next to you. Maybe someone whose exploits will be studied by our children's children. And to that end, we sent our own Nancy Lopez West out in search of a modern-day legend. Snap Judgment.
The year was 1967. Larry Calloway was a young reporter who'd just moved to Santa Fe in New Mexico to take on a new job. He didn't know much about the local politics, that is, until he first encountered a man by the name of Reyes López Tijerina.
Así tampoco nunca un gobierno extranjero ni una raza extranjera nunca podrá contra las leyes de la naturaleza tratarnos con igualdad a los internados como a los hijos.
Tijerina was weaving this dream of restoring the old land grants in northern New Mexico and establishing almost something like a separate country where people could live and speak Spanish and follow their own traditions. He had been an evangelistic preacher, and when he spoke in Spanish or English, he transfixed his audiences. And that's the first time I'd seen him, and I thought, wow, this man has really got some power.
Tijerina's followers were the descendants of the Native American and Mexican people, who had lived in the region decades and even centuries before the U.S. took over. Tijerina insisted they were still the rightful owners of the land, and that they should fight for it, literally, by any means necessary.
I thought that it was a great story and that it had a lot of potential. So I covered the land grant movement in those days as best I could. I had other duties as a state capitol reporter, but when I had a chance, I would try to call him and get his comments on stories.
And it was one small quote Larry got from Tijerina that would ultimately change the course of history. For Tijerina, for the land grant movement, and even for Larry. Larry had interviewed Tijerina about a big meeting that he and his followers were organizing.
A meeting that he said was going to be a showdown between his group and the Forest Service. A lot of people were feeling oppressed by forest rangers because they could not just go out and use the forest as they always had for generations, for centuries even. And the quote, they were going to have a showdown, went national, and that was my quote that I took from him.
But this quote didn't sit well with Santa Fe's district attorney, Alfonso Sanchez, who was fed up with Tijerina's antics. So he took drastic measures to keep the meeting from even happening. One day, Sanchez ordered local police to set up roadblocks on the highways and to arrest any of Tijerina's followers. They arrested 11 of his men. The following Monday, these men were to be arraigned for unlawful assembly in a small courthouse in the town of Tierra Amarilla.
When I heard in the radio that they had gotten so many of our people and that they were going to arraign them that morning, oh, God forbid, I felt something, a spirit. First thing that came to me is go to Tierra Maria and get Sanchez at all costs.
It was a rainy day, and this courthouse had a tin roof, and they had to stop every now and then because the rain was too loud. Nobody could hear. There were about a dozen defendants there, and there were a lot of people watching, and the judge, an old frontier-type lawyer named Scarborough, James Scarborough, obviously thought that the charges were sort of trivial, so he just released everybody without asking for bond.
The defendants walked out of the courthouse, and Larry went to file his story.
I was in the lobby in a little makeshift telephone booth, had, you know, a glass window in the door, and I was talking to my editor in Albuquerque, and suddenly there was a shot. Behind me in the hall where a state police officer had been standing, and so I turned around. I saw a couple of guys, one of them had a gun. I got crouched down in the phone booth and kept talking on the phone and told the editor, you know, somebody just fired a shot, but they'll probably get him in a minute. And then all hell broke loose. I didn't know what the hell was going on, except that there were a lot of angry people with guns. I told the editor it looks like a raid, and I knew who it was. It was the Land-Grant people, obviously.
Larry had just caught a glimpse of none other than Tijerina walking past him in his hiding spot.
He had a semi-automatic handgun, and that's about all I saw of him.
What Larry didn't know was that Tijerina was searching for the district attorney, Sanchez, to put him under citizen's arrest. What Tijerina didn't know was that Sanchez was not even there, and that the judge had freed his comrades a half hour before. The chaos continued.
There was a whole lot of people running into the courthouse. There were a lot of gunshots everywhere. There were people screaming and running up and down the stairs. A lot of the shooting was pretty wild outside of the deputy that got shot and the state cop that got shot. And I knew that fear does not help you in a situation like this. As a matter of fact, it can get you killed, so you try to be as cool as possible.
But then Larry, still crouched down in the telephone booth, was surprised by one of Tijerina's men.
A young man named Baltazar Martinez, the most fearsome of all of them, a guy with a beret and a trench coat with dynamite in the pockets and an army carbine in his hand, he bashed open the door of the phone booth where I was crouched down, stuck the carbine in my face, and prodded me down into the same room with everybody from the county. They're all sitting there looking pretty scared. Baltazar Martinez, the guy with the trench coat and the beret, said something else in Spanish, which I didn't understand, and somebody poked me and said, "He's talking about you, man. Get out." So I got up and walked out into the hall. He had a compatriot, an old man with a pistol, who had handcuffed the deputy with his own handcuffs behind his back, and they tied my hands with an electrical cord behind my back. The old man in Baltazar kicked us outside, put us into the deputy's car. My whole instinct was just to survive and wait for my chance, if it ever came up, to get away from this.
Tijerina wanted to make a getaway, too. He had a two-way radio on him, and that's when he heard that the state of New Mexico was calling all units to descend on Tierra Amarilla Courthouse. He knew his time was up. Tijerina went one way, and Larry was stuck with Baltazar going another.
We were in the deputy sheriff's car. Baltazar was driving it, and he picked up the microphone in the sheriff's car and on the police radios said, "I've got hostages. I don't want to see no cops." And there were no cops anywhere. The highway for 20 miles completely empty.
But then they came upon a roadblock full of state police officers. Baltazar stopped the car.
And he got out and took the deputy sheriff with him as a shield with a gun to his head. The old man pushed me out of the car and put the carbine to my head and started toward the ranch house, which was where they were going, and using me as a shield. At that point, I was quite concerned that I could get shot either from one side or the other. So I decided to act. And I turned as fast as I could, slapped the gun away, kicked the man and took away the carbine and threw it in the mud. And the cops jumped over the cars and came and knocked him to the ground and handcuffed him. And I was free. And that's when I probably started to get to show signs of being afraid. It took me 20 minutes or so to recover.
As soon as he did, Larry was back on the phone with his editor in Albuquerque.
I knew this was a big story.
Larry went back to the courthouse in Tierra Amarilla, where a big encampment had already been formed. That same night, perched on a mountain, Tijerina looked down to see the largest manhunt in New Mexico history being staged. All those forces looking for him.
By then, the national press and all the networks were there.
County courthouse in New Mexico, where the Wild West is still plenty wild. A band of disgruntled Spanish-American rebels claiming millions of acres under ancient land grants shot up the court and kidnapped 20 persons.
And that's when the press dubbed Tijerina King Tiger. The National Guard was trying to track him down, but their search kept coming up empty.
It caused a great deal of national, worldwide attention to the land-grant movement in New Mexico and made Tijerina a worldwide hero to some people.
A song praising Tijerina's battle played over the radio, even as authorities locked him up in jail. But the standoff between Tijerina and the authorities was far from over. What happened in the following weeks and months was just as surprising as a courthouse raid, especially for Larry. Tijerina was thrown in jail for 35 days before his case went to trial.
The prosecutor of Tijerina was the very same district attorney, Alfonso Sanchez. The prosecution had a story that incriminated Reyes Lopez Tijerina of a lot of things that really were not consistent with what I had seen. The prosecution did not call me as a witness, but then Tijerina called me.
I had educated myself on the question of citizen's arrest. How far could you go? And it says that you must use all possible force. We had the right to arrest even the president.
Tijerina had fired all his lawyers and was now defending himself.
And I was called as a hostile witness by Tijerina in his trial. and I testified about what had happened.
Tijerina was finally face-to-face with Sanchez and could argue his case for citizen's arrest. As far as he was concerned, Sanchez was a criminal. But no one believed Tijerina's argument actually stood a chance.
But Tijerina got off. The jury found him, acquitted him of a whole bunch of charges in the courthouse raid on the basis of his defense.
The land never did go back to the people, but Tijerina's fight became legendary. Martin Luther King Jr. and Cesar Chavez reached out to him soon after the raid. Once free, Tijerina was back, speaking to his people and fighting for his cause.
Rey López Tijerina, the Alianza, the brown people, the Indo-Hispano, this is the fire that is coming out of the volcano, which is in the northern part of New Mexico. And as much as the devil, as much as the enemy, as much as the oppressor would like to have the world believe that I'm a king tiger, that I'm a militant, that I'm a violent man, he is mistaken. For I am as violent as Jesus Christ.
Today, Tijerina's 88 years old. He feels as strongly now as he did then about the justice he sought at Tierra Amarilla.
Incredible, incredible. Turning me into the most wanted by the cops and the army. And, oh, wow. That day was the greatest day in my life.
Su jefe le suplicaba, no debería haber violencia, pero no los controlaba, pues perdieron la paciencia. Un diputado en el suelo.
Big thanks. Larry Calloway. Now you see that? You see him go back into work after being held hostage? We could use some more of that around here, I'm telling you what. Thanks to King Tiger as well for writing a new chapter in our history books, and big thanks to Latino USA for their extraordinary support in helping us bring this story to life with real voices from real people. That piece was produced by our own Nancy Lopez with sound design by Pat Massini Miller, Renzo Gorio, and Leon Morimoto. Now, when Snap Judgment returns, it's the legend of the office park. You do not want to miss this. Snap Judgment, stay tuned.
Support for Snap Judgment comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Thanks for listening to Snap. Imagine you could call up a friend and say, "Meet me at the bar and tell me what's going on with the economy." Now imagine that's actually a fun conversation. Now stop imagining and subscribe to Planet Money Podcast. Find Planet Money on iTunes along with other NPR podcasts.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the legendary episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're exploring the lives of people who have seared a mark on those of us left behind. Snap Judgment producer Joe Rosenberg recently read an article in The Billfold by Mike Hobb, and it was about just such a situation. Joe wondered how it might play out if we adapted said article for the Snap. Well, Joe, wonder no more. Snap Judgment.
The first thing that happens is somebody tells you. It's my first day back at work after a week on vacation. I notice the candle on the reception desk just as the whoosh of the door blows it out. I wonder why they never did that for my birthday. Dominic and Naomi are here already, sitting at opposite desks. Naomi moved here 3 months ago from Australia. She still has that new hire enthusiasm. She still says things like, "This is going to be such a great project, you guys." We're all waiting for it to wear off. "Mike, don't open your emails," Dominic says. Then I notice that our office has a candle in it, too. "You need to know," he says, "that Colin has passed away." Colin in marketing. The guy at the back of the external relations office. It turns out last Monday, Colin didn't show up to work. On Tuesday, his boss told HR. On Thursday, the office manager went to his apartment and found his body. They didn't want to tell his coworkers right before the weekend, so they waited till Monday. Colin was depressed, Dominic says. He had some emotional problems. So it looks like... Are you saying he killed himself? Nothing's clear right now. I barely knew Colin. He sat two offices down from me, but we never worked on anything together. We never existed to each other after 5 p.m. Our relationship consisted in its entirety of work-related small talk in the break room while his lunch rotated behind us in the microwave. I stare at my keyboard for a second. I don't know what else to do, so I type in my password, I open Outlook. There's the announcement from our managing director, and an invite from comms asking us to record our memories of Colin. Naomi's still looking at me. "So, how was your vacation?" The next thing that happens is we are terrible. I don't want to say I saw it coming or anything, but it's not exactly out of the blue. This is Bill. He runs our Twitter feed. The roof of our building is the size of a soccer field, but we're huddled together by the door, hoods up, facing away from the wind. Bill's the only one smoking. The rest of us are just listening. "They were working him too hard," says Will, one of the copy editors. "Marketing's way understaffed." I've been having conversations like this all over the building. It's Wednesday, 2 days since they announced Colin died. And this is how we've spent it. Bunched up in corners, whispering things to each other to see if they're true. Sarah from finance wonders if Colin's death has anything to do with the department restructuring. Mark in HR heard Colin hasn't taken a vacation for 2 years. Tina from photos heard Colin moved here to study economics, but dropped out because he couldn't do the math. "You know they changed his job title without consulting him," Bill says, and the rest of us nod solemnly. "He was gay," I say. "Do you think that had anything to do with it?" I only found this out yesterday, when Dominic mentioned Colin's boyfriend had been notified. Everyone else knew it already, but I wondered if it connected us somehow. The only two gays at the office. Could I have reached out to him? That lasted about 3 minutes. "The weird thing is," says Jessica, the receptionist, "Colin doesn't even strike me as the unhappiest person here. I would have put him way down the list. Like, look at Chris in online. That guy puts in earbuds when he walks to the bathroom." "Check out Dawn in legal," Bill says. "The cleaning ladies have to come to his desk every night just to vacuum up all the fingernails." "I saw Lucy talking to the external relations director yesterday," Jessica says. "I think she's applying for his job."
"I hope it's not her," Bill says. "Remember that presentation she gave at the annual meeting?"
We all laugh. Bill lights another cigarette, and that gives us all permission to stay out here at least 5 more minutes. The next thing that happens is we mourn. It's Thursday, 3 days since they told us about Colin. It's 10 a.m., our weekly staff meeting. I'm leaning against the floor-to-ceiling windows looking out onto our courtyard. Naomi, the new girl, is sitting next to me, eyes red like she's already been crying. At the front, Colin's picture is projected on the wall. The senior management team is sitting in suits at the big conference table, each with their own box of tissues. For the last 2 days, comms has been recording employees talking about Colin, how they want to remember him. Today we're going to watch the video. "I've heard some speculation about the cause of Colin's death," the managing director says from the front. "It stops now. Colin died of natural causes. When we know the exact cause of death, we'll let you know." The video begins with Colin's work. Excerpts of promos he made, products he launched, conference presentations he gave. Then the rest is testimonials from his colleagues. They're played in reverse hierarchical order. Interns, then coworkers, then bosses. They describe working with Colin. The time they bumped into him at the printer. The time he wrote something nice in their birthday card. The time they sat together on an overnight flight to a conference in South Korea. "I always said hi to Colin when I passed him in the hall," says someone on the video. Colin's boss is on vacation this week. He recorded a message by webcam. He He's lying on his side on a hotel bed, and he's talking about the clarity of Colin's press releases as palm trees shudder in the wind behind him.
I wish I'd gotten to know him better, he says. He seemed nice.
Naomi stops crying at that exact moment. She makes a little huh sound, like the DVR just froze in the middle of Titanic. I turn my head out the window, and there's a huge piece of bird crap on the windowsill.
So,
people are still talking on the video. The last clip is the managing director, chest heaving, telling the camera how Colin prepped him for his first TV interview.
Don't gesture so much,
Colin told him.
Gesturing looks awkward on TV. Emphasize with your words, not your hands.
The managing director did his interview a whole hour with his hands in his lap. Afterwards, he asked Colin,
how did I do?
And Colin said,
you were like a statue up there. Why didn't you use your hands?
And we all laugh, and the camera turns off, and the screen shows Colin's picture again. The next thing that happens is it makes us close. After the staff meeting, we shut the door to our office, and Naomi asks me if that was my first funeral. The first one at work, anyway, I say. I tell her about my last one, for my godmother who got brain cancer when I was 12. Did you know her well? Naomi asks. In whatever way kids know adults, I guess. I mostly remember her mac and cheese. Then I ask Naomi, and she tells me about the principal of her Catholic school, who died in a car accident when she was 7. It was her first funeral, and she raised her hand in the middle of a eulogy to ask a question. As she's telling it, I realize I never knew she went to Catholic school. It's like this the rest of the week. Maybe it's because the managing director ordered us to stop speculating, or maybe everyone else saw the video like I did, felt the same urgency to populate this place. But we stop talking about Colin, and we start talking about us. On the roof, Bill tells me his parents died when he was 22. He had just finished his first triathlon, and he was so tired he fell asleep on the note his roommate left on his bed. He woke up, pulled it out from under the covers, and read it, still in his little running shorts. Dominic lives in the same direction as me, and on Friday we ride our bikes together, side by side, like cowboys. He tells me about the cat he buried in his backyard when he was 7. I dug him up 2 years ago, he says, and he was just this box of bones. He takes his hands off the handlebars and makes 2 fists in his mittens to show me its size. Then he peels off towards home. The last thing that happens is we forget. Monday morning, I walk past marketing and I hear someone say, did you see Jessica crying at the staff meeting? She barely even knew him. Did Naomi send the agenda last week for the meeting with research? Dominic asks. I don't think so, I say. With everything happening last week, she must have forgotten. Well, if people are going to be here, they might as well be working. It's not that we forget, it's just that we're done remembering together. As the memorial fades from memory, our dead colleague becomes just another thing we think about but don't say. No one ever tells us how he died. I come back to the office and I ask Dominic if he had any other pets growing up, or just that one cat. What? What cat? The one you buried in the backyard. Did you guys get another one after that? Look, do you have the action points from the strategy consultation? If you don't send those to marketing, they're just going to sit up in that office and do nothing like they always do. Naomi is sitting there listening to us. I didn't realize it before, but she hasn't said anything enthusiastic in a while. A few weeks later, she quits. I'm going back to my old job in Adelaide, she says. We're sitting on the stoop of a church near work, with styrofoam coffee cups, watching the rain drip from the awning. Why? I ask. Do you remember Colin? I tell her I barely knew him. Neither did I, she says. But do you remember the week after he died? For the first time, we talk about the memorial, how we were with each other afterwards, how we're not anymore. I keep making these pledges to get to know people here, she says. And then in the very next second, I know that I'm not going to, that it's too hard. At least back in Australia, I have family waiting for me at the end of the day. I feel like we should hug or something. But instead, I stand up, I take the empty coffee cup out of Naomi's hand, and I throw it in the trash. The last time we talk about Colin at work is in a budget meeting. It's 6 weeks since he died. Dominic and I are in the conference room with marketing, getting an overview of our spending before the quarterly board meeting. We're all looking at a big Excel sheet, following the numbers with our pencils. What's this $40,000 that appeared in the budget in February? Dominic asks. That's Colin, says Bill. Dead people don't get salaries, so Colin's appears as a surplus. Okay, Dominic says. And that's it. We just move through the rest of the spreadsheet. I think about looking up, making eye contact across the table, sharing an acknowledgement of the moment that just passed. But I don't.
Thank you so much, Mike Hobb. That piece was adapted from a story on thebillfold.com. We'll have a link on snapjudgment.org. It was produced by Joe Rosenberg with sound design by Pat Mesiti-Miller. You have reached the end of the legendary episode, but not the end of the legend. Listen to me when I tell you, more Snap awaits. Full episodes, pictures, podcasts, movies. Let your Snap flag fly. SnapJudgment.org. iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Android devices, other services where gold is given away like straw. It's all available for you. Snap Judgment was produced by a legendary core of producers, the likes of which the world has never seen. Please, give him some love. The Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Mesiti-Miller, Anna Sussman, Julia DeWitt, Renzo Gorio, Joe Rosenberg, Nancy Lopez, Davey Kim, Leon Morimoto, Jasmine Aguilera, and Will Urbina. Do you know how to talk your way past those big, muscle-bound bouncers at the fancy Hatton Club downtown? Well, neither does the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, is already in the club, exchanging public radios. PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago won't be WBEZ by the likes of those thinking they're all WBEZ up in this piece. And certainly by this point, you have ascertained that this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could ride astride a white horse, ask the king for the princess's hand in marriage, and when he tells you to slay the dragon first, tell him that perhaps a different challenge will be in order, like rubbing the belly of the royal dog or posing for the royal picture. You could do that and still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.